The pride, passion, and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
Hey, we welcome all of you back. Second half of the show, and guess who's here? Connor O'Gara from Saturday Down South. And Connor, it's always great to have you on, and I want to compliment you. You have been predicting since Mike Leach got to Mississippi State that they would be a top 10 team, or at least relevant, and they're a top 10 team based on our guest after you's FPI rankings. Congratulations, and let's celebrate.
Paul, I really appreciate that. That means a lot. I'm impressed that you remembered me coming on 3 years ago and referencing a Mississippi State team that I was extremely high on. And, you know, I was definitely wrong on that. I said that they would win 10 games in the regular season. But, you know, it just took a couple of years.
Well, I forgot they had a different coach then, didn't they?
Yeah.
Joe Moorhead, wherever you are. It doesn't matter. But I am interested, though, Connor. And I realize FPI uses an unusual metrics, apparently one that doesn't agree with what all of us see. But how do you think or do you see a path for Mississippi State really to be that relevant? Forget the top 10, but somewhere significantly better than last year.
There's a lot of room for improvement. There's no doubt. A top 10 team? No. I saw that ranking and I thought to myself, someone is looking way too far into returning production. Maybe there's some sort of metric that factors in Leach's year two success that he's had in the past at Texas Tech, at Washington State. That's why I think Mississippi State should definitely improve. And the fact that you got Zach Arnett back to coach up that defense, you didn't have one of those bigger programs come in and poach him. That's important. But at the same time, they still can't block anybody. I don't know how you can be a top 10 team if you can't figure out how to block a three-man front. And Mississippi State wasn't able to do that to save its life last year. So it's tough to envision a top 10 program or a path to a top 10 finish for this team when, yeah, they beat Tulsa in the bowl game. That was cool. They weren't without their best defensive player, one of the best defensive players in all of college football. But at the same time, I'm not going to sit here and say that they're going to come anywhere close to that top 10 ranking.
Well, let's talk about the year. And I particularly want to go to an article you wrote the other day about Tennessee. And Tennessee has, we all know, has had an avalanche of bad news. And you know, the question is, when does it end, and when do they turn the corner? You did a fairly deep dive into it. What are your thoughts?
I think some of this was inevitable, and we typically see roster turnover with coaching changes, but I think when you have a situation like this where just such a different set of circumstances now that Josh Heupel is dealing with, some of these things are inevitable and some of these things he's brought on himself. We talked before about the whole story about him pulling an offer from a high school recruit the day before signing day and how he didn't even call the kid. I thought it was a pretty bad look that it took him 3 weeks to hire his defensive coordinator, and it was a defensive coordinator who's never been kind of in total control of a defense. With all due respect to Tim Banks, I think that's something that's at least worth noting, and Tennessee paid a lot to get him after some pretty public rejections. And then you've had some off-the-field issues with arrests, and you have four players involved in arrests. You have a player abusing a kitten. I mean, it just hasn't been the best set of headlines for Tennessee. And I think that right now, if you're Josh Heupel, you hope that your play can do the talking. You hope that your high-flying offense can do the talking, because I don't think that defense is going to do the talking. I think it's going to be the worst defense in the SEC this year. And I think that they have a long ways to go to show that they can just keep their head above water in what should still be a pretty good SEC East with some improvement across the board.
Connor, you like to go out on a limb, and you did it a couple of years ago with the aforementioned State pick. As you look ahead to the 21 season, we're getting pretty close. Spring games are happening this weekend and next. Is there someone that you're willing to put a couple of chips on and maybe get a big return?
In terms of the team that I think can make me look dumbest, kind of think Mizzou is that team. I'm really interested in year two of the Eli Drinkwitz era. And, you know, I feel like they're the team that's super under the radar, despite the fact that they rose above those expectations in year one, and to get to 5-5 with all the things that were working against them, I thought was really impressive. They have a ton of questions to answer on the defensive side of the ball. When you lose a player of Nick Bolton's caliber, that matters. Steve Wilks, new defensive coordinator there, is hoping to do some big things, but that's a program where I just kind of wonder if Eli Drinkwitz is the up-and-coming guy that we're sort of sleeping on, because year one was really promising. And I think that they're going to have to rely on Connor Bazelak a lot more in year two. They need to be able to stretch the field. I know they're high on Mookie Cooper, the Ohio State transfer. Kiki Chisholm finished the year really, really well in that passing game, but they still need to find a replacement for Larry Rountree. I just kind of wonder, though, is Eli Drinkwitz one of these guys that's always going to find a way? And in kind of typical Mizzou fashion, are they just going to hang around and be that pesky team? They beat a couple of teams last year that nobody expected them to beat. I thought that they played really well in the second half of that game against Alabama. When I had Eli Drinkwitz on Saturday Down South podcast, he said that second half against Alabama in the opener was when he realized he had something. He realized that he had a team that was actually going to be able to hold its own in the SEC, and I thought that's exactly what they did. So they're the team that I think nobody's going to be talking about at all, but could they finish in the top 25? Absolutely.
You know, this scares me, Connor. I agree with you. I am really sold on Drink. And you mentioned Steve Wilks, and I had a chance to visit with him recently. And, you know, he might be one of the best hires of the year in college football. And I think frankly, he is. When you hear what he's all about, understand where he's been, and digest the relationship that he has had with players in the past, and I think is already developing on that campus.
Eli Drinkwitz has done a really good job of figuring out his defensive staff. I thought being able to keep Ryan Walters on board from the Barry Odom regime was a huge deal. And I thought that helped a lot with some of the transition that he had to deal with. And maybe part of the reason why they were better than expectations in year one, to be able to retain the defensive coordinator. Obviously, Ryan Walters ends up going to Illinois and he joins Brett Bielema's staff. But I still think they should be set up for success. I think that Blaze Aldridge, the transfer from Rice, is a kid who SEC fans are going to learn pretty soon, a very prolific player at that level. But he's going to have some big shoes to fill, of course, with Nick Bolton gone. But I do find myself more and more intrigued. And I think by the day, people are going to learn that Mizzou is not necessarily a bottom feeder SEC program, as some make them out to be.
And this next question sounds like it would be asked on the Connor O'Gara Saturday Down South podcast, but because I don't normally ask questions like this, but you bring out the worst in me. Who is getting too much hype right now?
I think LSU is getting a little bit too much hype, and I'm not necessarily going to talk about the off the field stuff because I don't know how much these current players are really having to deal with that on a daily basis. If they're not the ones answering the questions, that's different. Even so much of this coaching staff, which looks very, very different than what it was even a couple years ago, I think doesn't have to deal with those questions in the same way that Ed Orgeron is. But I think that's the team where defensively they were just such a disaster last year. And I know Bo Pelini's gone, and you know there are high expectations for that secondary, not just with Derek Stingley, but with Eli Ricks as well. But we need to see it from them. And I question how quickly things can really turn around with how bad they looked for most of the year. And I know that they finished the year last year with those two wins, but those two games could have gone either way. I mean, if not for some totally inept tackling on that Kayshon Boutte touchdown in the Ole Miss game, who knows what we're talking about if Florida doesn't throw a shoe. I mean, LSU is easily looking at a three-win season, and I like what they have returning on offense, and I'm optimistic about that. But defensively, they were just so far behind last year. And, I guess that can be fixed with a coordinator, but that's a brutal schedule, and I think that we're gonna find out a lot about how they look in that opener against UCLA, going on the road and seeing what this group is going to be able to do against Chip Kelly's offense. But yeah, that's the team that when people have them in like top 12 or something like that, I'm kind of like, nah, I kind of need to see it a little bit first.
Connor O'Gara, let's get to the big dogs and start with Georgia. You see the hype, you hear it. It's everywhere. Buy it?
Yeah, well, you talked about this a little bit ago, and I'm buying Georgia to win the SEC. I think that Georgia has that type of potential, despite the fact that they've had some injury issues so far with some of the receivers. Just get those guys in bubble wrap right now, because they need to be healthy for the year for JT Daniels to effectively run Todd Monken's offense. But I think defensively, like I just said with LSU, we still have some questions, but at least we've seen Kirby Smart sort of weather the storm on that end. And I think for the most part, they should still be a unit that produces against the lesser teams. Now, against some of the high-powered offenses, you know, Clemson's of the world, what are they going to do against Florida? That's a different question, but at least now they have the offense to be able to kind of run with that. So I think that Georgia is a team that, you know, I'm buying the hype. I don't think they're winning a national championship this year and ending the 1980 jokes. But yes, I am a believer. I like what we've seen from JT Daniels, despite the fact that he does have to improve his accuracy. I just think that them modernizing really helps what they're able to do, and it's going to give them a chance to look more like what these SEC powers have looked like in recent memory. Look at the teams who win the SEC. Look at the teams who compete for SEC championships. I mean, Florida last year having the number one passing offense in the country, Alabama, of course, what it was doing, and then LSU the year before. I mean, you need to have this offense that can stretch the field vertically and do it in a moment's notice. And I think Georgia finally has that.
And Alabama, it's so prosaic just to say, sure, they're going to be in the playoffs, but they are, with one exception. What are your concerns about Alabama?
I'm interested to see the Bryce Young-Bill O'Brien relationship. And I think Bill O'Brien's going to have a lot of success. I don't think that's going to be an issue. And I think that Saban's track record of hiring offensive coordinators is pretty good. And even Brian Daboll, which didn't necessarily work out because he didn't gel with Jalen Hurts, Brian Daboll's still gone on to have a pretty darn good career and is very well respected in the NFL as an offensive mind. But I think that watching that relationship play out is going to be interesting. What does it look like when things aren't going well for Bryce Young? Does he gel with Bill O'Brien? Are they able to kind of huddle up on the sidelines and be perfectly in sync? Because that's what Mac Jones and Steve Sarkisian did so well. And Mac Jones, as you know, used to be the guy who would let one mistake sort of carry over and carry into the next play. And he got away from that. And Steve Sarkisian was part of that. He was kind of that even-keeled guy. And, you know, he knew in terms of what Mac was capable of in that offense. And that ended up being capable of a lot. So Bryce Young, the entire playbook should be open. I'm excited to see what this group does. But I do think that that's what it's going to come down to is how much do they gel when things aren't going right? And can they come up with that big time play when things do get tight? Because that's not an easy thing to do. And the last two quarterbacks who came before them, along with their offensive coordinator, they made that look pretty easy at times.
Always great nuggets from Connor O'Gara from Saturday Down South. You can hear him on the podcast. How often does your podcast come out?
Saturday Down South podcast is once a week, midweek. But yeah, Paul, we're going to have you back on, and I can we can talk some Mississippi State takes.
I cannot wait. Connor, thanks. Great to have you here. Always good to see you. Connor O'Gara joining us from Saturday Down South, and we're heading to a break. We're an hour away, under an hour, from the man who has stirred it up today for all of us, Seth Walder from ESPN. He's the FPI guru. Until then, more of your phone calls right after this.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%. This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
And we are back. And we appreciate you being here. Seth Walder, an hour from now, half an hour from now, 45 minutes. So he'll be here in 6 o'clock hour talking about his FPI. We'll go over that again in a few minutes, but it's quite interesting if you're just joining us. Let us get to some more calls here. And Billy is up next in Philly. Hello, Billy.
Hi, I have a non-football question for you.
Okay, sure.
I wonder if you believe that the generation gap between, like, high school, college kids and their parents and whatnot is narrower in the South than the North, and if the SEC has anything to do with it.
So let me make sure I understand you. You said the generation gap is I'm not sure I followed exactly.
The attitude, I mean— people in the Northeast, their kids go away to school, and Thanksgiving they come home and they terrify their parents with all sorts of things that the parents never heard because they were taught that their parents were all wrong about things. And
right.
Really,
okay. Okay.
You know what I mean?
I do understand that. Well, in the South, it's different because, first of all, you see your parents more. Because a lot of times your parents are going to the game on Saturday, where in the North that's not happening.
Correct.
I think
correct.
I do understand it. Yeah, it's. I would say it's totally different based on because I went to school, even though I went to school in the same state, it was 7.5 hours away from where my folks live. So I didn't go home. It was too hard. I didn't have a car and I didn't go home. So I didn't really see them really until Christmas, and it was different. It was completely different than for my friends who were driving home in the same city or 2 hours away or 3 hours away.
Yeah. I mean, you can go to a Princeton football game in a fabulous stadium.
Right.
And sit there with maybe 2,300 people. 2,300.
No, I understand. It's and I tell you, I've always wanted to go to a Princeton Tiger football game.
The game isn't that bad.
No, Princeton's one of those schools that if I could just have a, you know, I would go somewhere else for graduate or law school, but Princeton I've always thought would be one of the cooler diplomas to have up in your office.
It is a cool diploma. I lived there for 17 years. I know pretty much how the school works and all that, and it's a gorgeous place, and they have everything.
No,
but I'm just curious if there's the idea that you have a state school as opposed to a bunch of private schools that all talk about themselves and that's it, seems to me that it ought to have some kind of positive effect. I mean, I gather just from your commercials that you have a fairly old audience. And it's not full of young kids. And that's why I asked you the question. I wonder if
Now, Billy, are you making that evaluation based entirely on Joe Namath being on every 15 minutes plugging Social Security?
No, but maybe am I wrong about that?
Well,
you know your audience. I don't.
Well, it's a little bit deceiving for a couple of reasons, and it's complicated. But there's because of the relationship that this network has with a conference, there are certain things that we do not put on the air that would normally be on the air if it were not for those restrictions. So that's a little bit. I mean, you are correct in interpreting what you see, but it may be deceiving in terms of the reality.
I am entirely comfortable with all the callers and the environment, and I'm just asking. I wonder if somebody 20 would feel it is just as comfortable as I would.
Well, no, probably not, Billy, because. Younger people, I mean, we tend, especially in this time of the year, to slow the pace down a little bit. And, you know, because my background is in radio and newspapers, I love the long story. I love a conversation like this about something that we don't normally talk about. The basic who, what, when, why of a football game on April 13th, you know, can be moderately tedious, but...
I don't think so at all.
But I've certainly. What? I'm interested. What were you doing in Princeton for 17 years?
Well, I worked on Wall Street, and I lived in Princeton, so I commuted in.
Took the train.
Yeah, it's a two-hour, a little less than a two-hour commute, and that's where I brought up my family.
Well, that is fantastic. Well, I'll tell you what, having spent quite a bit of time in and around Wall Street, I spent not this past fall, obviously, but the previous two falls in New York most of the week, and our studio was right on the Hudson River, not too far from Wall Street. You chose wisely.
Yeah, I wanted to get away. Right?
Yeah, no, I used to think because my folks are from New York. I used to think, man, would I give to live in New York? And when I lived in New York for three nights a week, I kept thinking, what would I do to never come back?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's changed, and older people like me don't think New York is as much fun as it used to be, or Princeton is as much fun as it used to be, but. I'm comforted by the people who talk on your show and the way you handle very challenging issues. And, you know, I think it's very intellectually stimulating. You know, I ask because I don't know. I hope that works for people younger than I am.
Well, Billy, we've been on for 7 years on this network and on the radio side for significantly longer. And the only thing I will say to you, because you spent the time on Wall Street, we've had a good record. That doesn't mean they won't come in tomorrow and say, you've had a good record and this is your final day.
I hope it doesn't end as abruptly as Wall Street. That can be fairly.
Well, by the way, I'm curious because I can think of a few off the top of my head, but what was I can think of 87 and obviously a couple of other points, but what was the most harrowing day you've ever had on Wall Street other than 87 and 9/11?
Well, yeah, I was not well. The terror for me was the Paul Volcker days.
Oh, okay.
I retired and I stopped working in 1990. I stopped working at a fairly early age.
Okay.
And I did it because I had enough money, didn't have to work anymore. So that's what I did.
Now, Volcker was the chairman of the Fed who sent interest rates, what, to 21%?
Yeah, I bought a Fannie Mae nine-month note at 18 and change. 18%.
That is incredible.
That's shocking. That is shocking. I mean, imagine, you're a salesman. The market, I'm in the bond business. As yields go up, prices go down. Every day, I had to call a guy whose product I sold him yesterday is worth less than it is today. That's tough training.
That is amazing. Yeah, well, let me talk to the young people for a second,
money.
Billy. Right now, you know, people are going crazy with homes and car loans are dirt cheap. And how long were we in the high teens and low 20s?
About a year.
Okay.
Months to a year. It wasn't a long time, and it was clear it was going to come down. We everybody knows those are suicide rates. You just can't have that, and so we didn't have it.
No, I know my mom, who was a product of the Depression. I mean, she thought it was great when you can get CDs for a high rate.
Yeah. Well, those were different days, and we're at different times now. This is not probably the place to talk about the Federal Reserve, but you asked about trauma.
No, I was just curious. Because,
every day you call a guy, and you're trying to make a living making him look good, and you just made him look terrible.
Yeah.
Day after day.
No, that's why. By the way, Billy, that's why the bars near Wall Street did such a good business back then.
Oh, they did. They did. Harry's, yeah.
Hey, thank you so much for calling, Billy. What a pleasure.
I love it. Thanks,
that was great.
Keep doing what you're doing.
I like that. He didn't say it boastfully or braggadociously. He said, I retired at a very early age because I made so much money, I didn't have to work anymore. That sounds good. What about you guys? We'll take a break. Seth Walder coming up in about 30 minutes, and we are back after this.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free. No insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at Hims.com/Paul. That's Hims.com/Paul for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/Paul. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan.
Welcome back. Great to have all of you here. And let's check in with Michael down in Florida. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Paul.
Hey there.
Can you hear me okay?
Hi, you sound great. You sure do.
Thanks. I just wanted to share another story about Coach Bryant. I'm 63, but I went to the University of Alabama via IBM Birmingham to work on typewriters at the campus before computers. And so I was an IBM Selectric 2. Do you remember those?
Oh, of course I do.
The little ball and everything. So the story I was wanting to tell you is I got a call from Vera Dowdle, and I worked under Walt Dinsmore and Finest Gaston at the time. But Vera had called me up and wanted me to do a pull of maintenance or clean Coach Bryant's typewriter. And we scheduled it for the next morning. And I got over there, and there was a young man that came in with long black hair. He was wearing a kind of a suit. It was black coat, a white shirt, wrinkled black tie, had an earring in his left ear. And so we were sitting there next together at the top of Memorial Coliseum, you know, where the offices used to be, and Vera's office. And then I remember, and you remember Ken Donahue?
Of course.
Ken Donahue was the coach at Alabama for.
Yeah, he was. Ken was the defensive coordinator under Coach Bryant.
Yes, he was, and he was imposing as much as Coach Bryant was. And he came out and he looked at me and said, "Okay, Michael, it might be another 30 minutes or so." And he looked down at this kid sitting next to me. And he said, "Coach Bryant will see you in about 5 minutes." And he leaned over and looked at the earring in his left ear. And he said, "You might want to consider taking that earring out." And this kid said, "No, that's fine. I'm comfortable with who I am." He said, "Okay." So about 10 minutes later, that oak door down at the end of that hallway, and it caught with a red carpet and everything, and Coach Bryant started walking down the hallway, and all these doors started opening from the assistant coaches, and he was signing papers and doing all this stuff. And this kid, he said, he stood up, and he went over to Vera's desk, and he asked her, he said, "Where's the restroom?" And she said, "Well, it's down the hallway here to the left. Take your first right." And then he came back out and sat down next to me, and I noticed he took the earring out. And that was actually, I can't remember the guy's name. He was from Playboy.
Oh, I do remember this. This guy was very well known. He did all the...
Richard something.
So this was the this was the infamous Playboy interview?
Yes. Yes, it was. And... I was sitting next to him, and it was so amazing when Ken Donahue walked out, which is an imposing figure. And Ken, I'm sure, was like 6'4 or better. But see, Ken, when I was at the university from 77 to 80, Ken, at the end of practices, they would take the football team after practice and run around the entire campus, and Ken would be in front of them. And he was at most of an imposing person. But it was so amazing to see this guy. And I think Richard, I don't know his last name, but I think he's written a few books, and he's from New York. But it was so amazing to see the influence that Coach Bryant had on people. I'll never forget seeing Coach Bryant my first time at the university carrying an IBM Selector from Carmichael Hall.
That is funny. I've typed on one of those.
Hit the elevator.
That's funny.
And everybody was gone. For that weekend, Dr. Ferguson, you know, the band director, everybody was gone. But I got in the elevator, and there was this grumbling voice going, "What floor?" And I looked over, and it was Coach Bryant. And I asked Grover Journey when I got back to the office, "What's Coach Bryant doing here in these buildings after everybody's left?" And Grover Journey told me that. And Bill Gray, who I love dearly, he's long since passed. He told me, he said, "Coach Bryant walks around on Friday afternoons after everybody's left and looks in classrooms and see if they need typewriters, desks, or anything." And there was a little church on campus, kind of close to Denny Chimes, believe it or not. And it was just stocked with boxes of typewriters and desk and all these materials, and Coach Bryant took that out of his own salary and would make sure that everybody in classrooms, even from his own salary, would and guess he called me the ugly car because I was an Auburn fan. I'm still an Auburn fan, but Coach Bryant was and I've got an autographed picture from Coach Bryant for my mother, my father, and myself that is dated January the 17th of 1983.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were so, he was such a good man, and he took care of people. And that's the story I just want to say.
Yeah, Michael, I will tell you just a little bit to piggyback that. I was the day after Coach Bryant died on a Wednesday, the 26th, and I went down. I was down there that day. On the 27th, I went by to see Linda Knowles. I don't know if you remember her. She was Coach Bryant's secretary.
Yes.
And she told me the eeriest thing. You know, he had like a little box, which you may have seen when you were there. Were messages, and she said. The morning that he died, she put a couple of these little pink while you were out messages. Young people don't know what we're talking about. And she said it was the eeriest thing that she was going to leave them there. She did not want to touch them. I'll never forget that. It was just a chilling moment to be outside of his office the day after he passed away, talking to somebody who was very close to him and see messages in his box.
That's amazing. And, you know, as a young boy and an Auburn fan, when I left IBM in Birmingham to go to work in Tuscaloosa before the transition from typewriters to computers, Coach Bryant always, he knew I was an Auburn fan. And he'd say, my car that I drove over that was owned by the government, he called it the ugly car. He said, "You're driving the ugly car." I said, "Yes, sir, I." But he always treated me with respect. I've been in Coach Bryant's office a few times. Yeah, I've seen that, and I know you have. If you've been in there,
yeah,
that big clay ashtray,
right,
with the elephant on it, and. He was a special man. And,
Michael, thank you so much. What an amazing memory! And that was the thing about him. He was a man of the people. And that sounds like a cliche, but you know, he grew up very poor in Arkansas and never forgot where he came from his first day at Alabama to his final day. We will take a break. More to come. More of your phone calls right after this.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We welcome you back, and Jim is up next. Hey, Jim, thanks. Good afternoon.
Hey, Paul.
Hey there.
Good to talk to you. Tell that guy from Princeton we talk about football. I want to set up a match between Alabama and Princeton in the pregame.
Yeah, no, I like Alabama's chances there.
Anyway, my problem is this COVID thing. I mean, they're going to ruin college sports if we let them continue. It just, when you look back at the past year, it's been over a year. What does it mean when they identify a positive case? And when you look back at it, really all the athletes and people that have had it, supposedly, the cases, nothing ever happens. They're asymptomatic. They're not sick. They don't need medicine. They're not hospitalized. They don't die. And there comes a point, if we don't stop the madness, we're going to lose college sports because we've been replaced by cardboard cutouts and people want to live. I think there comes a point where you have to look at it objectively and consider the censorship of the truth and realize that, you know, we've done everything they've ever said. We've made idiots out of ourselves and worn these stupid, dangerous masks. And now they still want it to go on and on and on till July. And what do you think about it, Paul? Do you think they're going to ruin college sports?
Jim, I don't. And the reason why I don't is that I think what we have been through, we are rapidly coming out of. And, some of it depends on where you live, but in a lot of parts of the country,
ironically enough, the states that mask the most, Michigan, have the highest cases of COVID. And it's what the doctors that are censored have always said, that you're not supposed to wear these dangerous masks that have carcinogenic ingredients, and these hand sanitizers are very dangerous. And see, when you don't let your immune system exhale the waste, it builds up on this mask. See, like in Michigan, now they've got huge spikes because people had to wear the damn masks.
Well, Jim, I don't know how to counter what you said other than to say that I think in 3 months from now, or we're 3 months away from the unofficial beginning of the college football season, I don't think it will be discussed at that point.
Florida and Texas. Florida and Texas are leading the way. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you. Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good day, and stay safe, as they say. Let's check in with Mike, who is in Georgia. Hey, Mike. How are you?
Hey, Paul. First-time caller.
Good to hear from you.
Got a question. Came up yesterday that a lot of people are interested in. The spring games were always broadcast.
Right.
And this year, I know you were unaware of it, you sounded like, and it's going to be streamed on ESPN Plus, SEC Network Plus. And unless you join a streaming service and pay for it, you're not going to be able to view it. Did you find anything out?
Yeah, I did find a little bit out. And there are several games that will be on ESPN, I believe. Maybe somebody in the back room can help me here. I know the Alabama game is going to be on ESPN this weekend.
Right.
And I'm not sure about that. In fact, I was curious about the Ole Miss game because of some circumstances. And that's also going to be streamed. And I think a couple of other games are. I'm not making excuses for anyone because nobody's ever told me how we came to this conclusion. I do know there are baseball and softball games on Saturday that, okay, here we go. Now, are these all what we're showing here? Are these games on Plus? Okay, so this Saturday we have Mississippi State at noon, Vandy at noon, LSU at 1, Auburn at 2, Georgia at 2, and Arkansas. And help me, somebody in the other room. These are all on Plus, correct? Okay, these are all on what would be described as SEC Network Plus. So the only game I'm aware of on Saturday that will be over the air on cable would be the Alabama game. I'm going to tell you that I really don't have what I would call a working paper here to read from, because I don't know the answer to that, other than I think it's pretty obvious where the priorities are and you know the everything. I'm just not going to say anything more because I really don't know.
Unfortunately, yes, and Georgia's really the one out. And my brother and cousin both played for Georgia, and I'm a diehard fan, and I can't walk the stadiums and everything like I used to, and I hate to miss it or.
Yeah, Michael, let me see if I can, and I should have done it today, but I'll get more on that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast. The Paul Feinbaum Show airs weekdays on the SEC Network, beginning at 3 Eastern.